Hello, and welcome to PubCasts, an ongoing project to experiment with science communication and making research more accessible and digestible to both scientific and general audiences. PubCasts are audiobook-style recordings of peer-reviewed scientific research, read to you by the authors. I'm your host today, Dr. Hannah Harrison. This series is hosted by the Conservation of Change Lab and the Coastal Roots Project. Coastal Roots is a project led by Dr. Philip Loring and myself, and aims at connecting research and storytelling about successful and novel adaptation to change in coastal communities in Canada and beyond. You can learn more about Coastal Roots by visiting www.coastalroots.org and check back in with the podcast to listen to new episodes and paper recordings monthly. PubCasts are inspired by a passion for podcasts, demystifying science, and the power of the human voice. Our goal is to give you, the listener, a new way to connect with research, and just as importantly, the researcher. These recordings will focus on trying to communicate a published research article in an engaging and convenient way. And I will sometimes stop to explain a concept, give a short anecdote about the research experience, or emphasize a main point. Our hope is that this format will give researchers and academics a new way to engage with the literature, and for the non-academics out there, a way to hear about new science that is more interesting and digestible. To keep things straightforward, you won't hear the in-text citations, long acronyms, or other details that make wading through an academic paper more challenging. But, like all peer-reviewed research, this work stands on the shoulders of the researchers who came before, so I strongly encourage you to visit the paper online and see the full reference list, as well as to enjoy the tables and figures that can help explain some of the more interesting findings. And of course, we would love to hear your feedback. If you'd like, please tweet your comments, questions, or suggestions to us. You can find our Twitter information in the online details of this episode. Today's paper is entitled Managing Many Nets: Possible Scenarios and Impacts for the Expansion of Cook Inlet Personal Use Fisheries, written by me, Hannah L. Harrison. This paper was published online in December of 2020 in the Fisheries Research Journal. You can read the full text and see the affiliations and other details about the authors at the Fisheries Research Journal website. Introduction, Part 1. How should fishery resources be shared? This question sits at the root of many complex fisheries conflicts, particularly those operating in a state of maximum allocation or where every fish in a system is already claimed by some actor, whether it be a fishing user group or the environment itself. A prime example of maximally allocated fisheries are those of Cook Inlet, Alaska, where multiple user groups have competed over allocation, access, and harvest opportunity for 5 species of Pacific salmon. These fisheries operate in a state of tenuous pluralism, or a coexistence that is contingent upon powerful actors seeking to maintain their access to the fishery, gain ground whenever possible, and mitigate losses when all else fails. Without reaching for a hyperbole here, it would not be overstated to say that the atmosphere of Cook Inlet fisheries management and allocation can be deeply emotional, personal, and destructive to the lives and livelihoods of those who participate. In their 2016 article, Philip Loring examined Cook Inlet fisheries through the lens of social ecological coexistence theory, or SCT, and pointed out that the contentious coexistence of these fisheries has functioned largely because there's a lot of fish. It's a highly abundant salmon resource. And the intense and ongoing conflict between these user groups undermines the resilience of biocultural diversity that the region could offer through its very multifaceted fisheries. Though these conflicts have historically been between marine-based commercial gillnet fleets of Upper Cook Inlet, or sort of the mid-region of Cook Inlet, and the in-river recreational angling interests, there is a relatively new and popular personal-use fishery that has emerged over the last 20 years or so, and it's become a pretty significant user group within the social ecological system of Cook Inlet salmon fisheries. Within that maximally allocated system, this growth of the personal use fishery has increased tensions and contributed to inequitable rights and access to Cook Inlet salmon harvests, including for Indigenous people, such as the local Kainai Indian tribe. Participation in Cook Inlet personal use fisheries has grown substantially since its inception, with participants harvesting upwards of sometimes 500,000 salmon in their peak years. This growth has contributed to annual cycles of increased friction between personal use, recreational, and commercial fishing interests in UCI, sometimes referred to in the news as the fish wars. While equalizing mechanisms like governance structure and constitutional mandates do exist and have helped to maintain degrees of equity between Upper Cook Inlet user groups, the personal use fishery has thus seen very few restrictions to growth. In early 2020, the Alaska Board of Fisheries, or the BOF, expanded the personal use fishery by opening a new fishing area on the Susitna River, a significant sport fishing river system that empties into the northern end of Cook Inlet. This raises the question of how, in a maximally allocated fishery like Cook Inlet, the opportunities and rights of existing user groups to access and harvest a public resource should be managed. What equalizing mechanisms, if any, can or should accompany the growth of any one user group? What impact does that group have on the resilience of other user groups and equity within the system as a whole? To examine these questions, this article draws from the scenarios development and planning literature to lay out potential scenarios resulting from the opening of the Susitna River personal use fishery. From those scenarios, I draw from Loring's discussion of social ecological coexistence theory, particularly around aspects of pluralism and equity, to discuss potential states of coexistence, or perhaps a lack thereof, in these Cook Inlet salmon fisheries. Now, importantly, this work does not seek to predict outcomes around the introduction of this new personal use fishery, as the system within which this new fishery operates is deeply complex, features conflict as an emergent property, and is unpredictable in light of shifting political and power structures, changing marine and freshwater ecosystems in the Gulf of Alaska, and other influencing social and ecological factors that truly confound predictability. The distinction between prediction and scenario development is critical, as while prediction requires a predictable set of variables, scenario development instead aims for, quote, a consistent and coherent description of alternative hypothetical futures that reflect different perspectives on past, present, and future developments, and which can serve as a basis for action, end quote. And that's from Van Naughton, 2005. Scenario development has been used in addressing natural resource management and development issues, such as an integrated management of forests, by helping communities, managers, and other agents explore visions of the future under these different scenarios. Scenarios development also allows managers and stakeholders to better understand the landscape of a particular issue and improve adaptiveness by offering information and vision to anticipated changes. This is particularly true in cases characterized by complexity and high degrees of uncertainty, such as I've mentioned, Cook Inlet fisheries. So, with that in mind, the goals of this article are to develop and describe potential scenarios around the outcomes of the expansion of this personal use fishery in Cook Inlet waters. And I'm going to pay particular attention to the historical, social, and ecological context of Cook Inlet fisheries, and, of course, importantly, discuss the new personal use fishery in the context of social ecological coexistence of Cook Inlet fisheries broadly. This article identifies four possible scenarios that could emanate from this new fishery, framed through intertwined descriptions of potential outcomes for recreational and sport fishers, commercial fishers, indigenous fishers, and, of course, personal use fishers. I conclude this article with a critical discussion of how these outcomes influence the plurality and equity of Cook Inlet fisheries, and, of course, what that could mean for future conflict in this region. Section 1.1, Background. I'm going to summarize this section a little bit and give you a little bit of background on the personal use salmon fisheries in Cook Inlet. So Cook Inlet has four primary user groups across the whole inlet. That's commercial, which takes place in terms of drift, set net, and seine nets, recreational in both marine and freshwater environments, personal use fisheries, which are the main topic of this paper, and a comparatively small number of educational fisheries, which are specific to Alaska Native groups. Personal use fisheries were created essentially to give people who lived in non-rural areas, so on the road system in Alaska, an opportunity to harvest fish for personal consumption, which is similar to subsistence, but under Alaska law is definitively a different category of harvest. All personal use fisheries in Cook Inlet are fished under the same broad personal use permit, which can be procured through the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and it allows individuals to take up to 25 Pacific salmon, although there are sometimes limitations around the retention of Chinook or King salmon. They can also take an additional 10 salmon per additional household member, so that's in addition to the 25, which is for the head of household. And this is across all of Cook Inlet and throughout the season. They do have to record their catch on permits, and they have to return those permits by the end of the year, which is usually a date specified on the permit itself. Failure to report that harvest can prohibit a fisherman from getting a permit in the future and can incur a fine or other penalties. Despite those penalties, however, compliance with permit return has actually steadily declined since record keeping began in 1996, with a 91% permit return in 1996 to now a 75% in 2018. Currently, the Kenai and Kasilof rivers on the Kenai Peninsula are the most popular places to fish in terms of number of people and the volume of salmon harvested. They're well known because they're usually pretty easy places to fish. The beach is relatively sloping and gentle, and it's easy for families to go down. There's usually room, especially at low tide, for lots of people to be there together. And most personal use fishers go with friends or family or sometimes co-workers to take part in the fishery. The majority of personal use fishers come from outside of the Kenai Peninsula area itself, so from the Anchorage or from the Matanuska-Susitna Valley region of Alaska, also known as the Matsu. And it's a usually 3 to 4 hour drive for people from those areas to get down to the Kenai and Kasilof rivers. We have found that in past research, personal use fisheries do contribute to regional food security, and though the increasing popularity of these fisheries has also led to sometimes crowded fishing conditions and associated environmental and social hazards like polluted beaches or water quality degradation. Those hazards have drawn criticism toward this personal use fleet, if you will, particularly within this already really contentious atmosphere of Cook Inlet fisheries management. Section 1.1.2, Creation of the Susitna Personal Use Fishery, the Board of Fisheries Process. I'll summarize quite a lot here as well. The Susitna River Personal Use Fishery was created by an act of the Alaska Board of Fisheries, or the BOF. The BOF is responsible for allocation decisions in Alaska state fisheries and is made up of 7 individuals who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Alaska legislature. They meet every 3 years on a rotational basis to discuss proposals and changes to a particular region's allocation of fisheries. It is the case that Board of Fish members are typically appointed with a known user group interest, so they have a background or an interest in recreational, commercial, or subsistence fisheries prior to their appointment to the board. Proposals to suggest changes to fisheries management plans can be made by private individuals or organizations, either to their local advisory committee or to the Board of Fisheries itself through a comment form, which are then reviewed by the 7-member Board of Fish and can be accepted by a majority vote, as well as amended by Board of Fish members. The proposal to create the Susitna River Personal Use Fishery was submitted by the Matanuska Valley Fish and Game Advisory Committee, though there were also other proposals that were quite similar that were submitted by other individuals unaffiliated with that committee. Now, interestingly, the Susitna River Personal Use Fishery was established in tandem with the lifting of a special status designation that was intended to protect Susitna River sockeye runs. In 2008, the Susitna River sockeye were classified as a stock of yield concern due to their repeated failure to meet the sustainable escapement goal on the Yentna River. A stock of yield concern is defined by the state of Alaska as, quote, a concern arising from a chronic inability, despite the use of specific management measures, to maintain specific yields or harvestable surpluses above a stock's escapement needs. A yield concern is less severe than a management concern. And that's as defined by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Now, the conservation of that stock, that sockeye stock, had been one of the underlying reasons that there had actually been past restrictions placed on the Upper Cook Inlet drift gillnet fleet, which is, of course, lower down in Cook Inlet. At the Board of Fish meeting in early 2020, that special status was lifted under the recommendation of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And in that same meeting, the Board of Fish also added additional restrictions to the Upper Cook Inlet drift fleet by restricting them to the Kenai and Kasilof sections, which are outlined in maps that you can see within the manuscript if you're interested. That decision to further restrict the drift fleet while also opening a new fishery and removing the special status of the sockeye stock within the Susitna drainage actually raised concerns from some Board of Fish members in terms of being equitable and actually good for the stock. You can read more about the nature of that conversation and some of the more specific points around allocation between user groups that were brought up in the actual manuscript. Let's move now to Section 1.1.3, the Susitna River Personal Use Fishery. Here, I talk quite a lot about the actual nature and character of the new fishery. So effective in April of 2020, a personal use dipnet fishery was opened on the Susitna River, which is a 313-mile glacial-fed river that flows from the Alaska Range, northeast of the Talkeetna Mountains, to where it empties into northern Cook Inlet. The Susitna River is a fast-flowing, turbid river, and it's joined by several other significant tributaries along the way. It is a significant sport fishing river in south-central Alaska, with runs of all five Pacific salmon species and several other popular sport fish. It's also the largest sport fishing river in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley and in the Anchorage area. The Susitna River personal use fishery follows very similar regulations to elsewhere in Cook Inlet, though it is open only 2 days a week, rather than the full 7 days a week that is common on the Kenai River. Chinook salmon cannot be retained, and fishermen have to return any inadvertently caught Chinook to the river immediately. It does also allow for the unlimited retention and destruction of northern pike, which actually can't be released alive because they are considered an invasive species in this region. Most notably about the Susitna River fishery is that the fishing area is really only accessible by boat or by small aircraft, and the nearest boat launch to the area is called Deshka Landing, and it's located about 20 miles upriver of the upstream regulatory markers of the new fishery, or at least an hour by boat. That is notably different than the conditions on the Kenai and Kasiloff River, both in terms of the character of the fishery, the nature of the river itself, the difficulty of fishing, as well as the fish stocks. For example, fish counts demonstrate that the Susitna River system has a very different abundance of sockeye salmon than does the Kenai or the Kasiloff. Suffice to say, without going into too much detail, that the abundance of sockeye and other salmon in the Susitna system are just much lower than that of the Kenai. I'll also note one other important difference, and that is that the Susitna River personal use fishery area is about 20 river miles from the northern end of Cook Inlet, so it's 20 miles of fresh water before it hits this fishery, whereas the Kenai and Kasiloff rivers are essentially being fished at the intertidal zone, so a very brackish or mostly salty area where the fish are still what we call to ocean bright, where they're still very silver in appearance and the flesh is still quite firm and high quality. In the case of the Susitna River fishery, the salmon are going to spend at least several days migrating beyond where they would be caught, say, in the Kenai River sport fish or personal use fishery, and they're more likely to be blushed or turning into their spawning colors and losing those ocean bright qualities. So that's also a significant difference in how people who are used to that ocean bright personal use caught fish, they're going to have to adapt to that change in meat quality. Now, as is pretty standard to these podcasts, I am going to skip section 2, which is the methods, though I do encourage you to go and look at those methods if you have questions about how this study and these scenarios were developed. And instead, I'm going to move to section 3, which is the result, and here I call it scenarios. There are 4 possible scenario configurations around the opening of the Susitna River personal use fishery when considering the variables of popularity of the fishery and demand for abundance. Those scenarios are a high popularity, high demand, or what I call the Susitna boom, low popularity and high demand, or what I call the vocal minority, low demand and high popularity, or what I call fishing for fun, or low demand and low popularity, or what I call the status quo. I'll now explore each of those scenarios in greater detail. Let's first look at scenario A, low popularity and low demand, or what I call the status quo. In this scenario, the Susitna River personal use fishery attracts a small number of new users and does not become as popular as the personal use fisheries on the Kenai and the Kasiloff rivers. Thus, overall harvest levels from this fishery remain relatively small, and there is no increase in demand from users for increased abundance of harvestable fish. Impacts on other Cook Inlet groups are pretty negligible, and impacts on the Kenai River and Susitna River environments are negligible as well. I do take time in each scenario, which is now section 3.1.1 and section 3.1.2, to discuss the rationale behind each scenario. As this scenario really has very little change, I'm going to skip over those sections and move instead into scenario B, which is section 3.2, high popularity, low demand, or what I term fishing for fun. In this scenario, the Susitna River personal use fishery becomes popular and draws a large number of fishermen, but there is no corresponding increase in user demand for fish abundance. Here I'll take a little bit more time to discuss the rationale. So as noted in scenario A, the Susitna River fishery is located in a place that is tremendously beautiful, has a lot of natural beauty, very wild in its feel, and it offers a comparatively quieter fishing atmosphere in comparison to the personal use fishery on the Kenai River, which can be a little wild sometimes. This new environment may attract many fishermen and lead to an increase in river traffic and subsequent impacts on the area surrounding that fishery, such as invasion of private property, erosion problems, or encounters with wildlife. Now, there may be some benefits to this. In this scenario, the DIPNET guiding charter sector in this that is already present in this region for recreational fishers might grow in capacity in order to accommodate non-boat owners who wish to fish that new Susitna personal use fishery. Though the fishery's capacity to support many more guides would probably be limited due to no real increase in fisheries abundance accompanying the opening of the fishery. That said, this fishery will certainly harvest salmon that would have been otherwise available for upstream sport fishermen, and thereby might decrease the abundance of fish reaching fisheries that are targeted by locals and high-end lodges that cater to fly-in tourists. This could potentially have a negative impact on the popularity of other salmon-targeted sport fisheries within the Susitna drainage if DIPNET fishermen are effective enough to noticeably reduce that upstream harvestable abundance. Other Cook Inlet user groups, however, are unlikely to see any significant change to their fisheries under this scenario. The Kenai DIPNET fishery might see some decrease in personal use boating traffic if people are taking their boats to the Susitna River instead, but overall, the changes are likely to be minimal. Section 3.3, Scenario C, low popularity, high demand, or what I term the vocal minority. In this scenario, a small number of users begin to utilize the Susitna River personal use fishery, and they create a noticeable public demand for increased fish abundance. So let's discuss the rationale of that a little bit. The logistical challenges and low abundance in comparison to other personal use fisheries of the Susitna River fishery prevent it from becoming super popular in terms of overall number of fishermen. However, those that do use it seek a greater harvestable abundance and want to see a larger allotment of the available Cook Inlet salmon that migrate through Cook Inlet as a whole allocated toward personal use fisheries. Thus, the demand from this small group would become disproportionately high in comparison to the number of users. Now, in terms of impact that that demand might have on other user groups and the environment, high demand, even from a small number of users, may have significant impacts on the rest of Cook Inlet user groups, which are discussed in detail in Scenario D, where high demand is also present. The primary difference between these two scenarios is whether the high demand receives attention from decision makers and fisheries managers. In the case of Scenario C, a small number of fishermen making notable demands, or that vocal minority, may have political and social impacts on the already contentious atmosphere of Cook Inlet fisheries. But they are unlikely to have the social or economic capital necessary to instigate substantial changes to the fisheries management itself, and thus the actual change in abundance would be unlikely to materialize. In terms of the Susitna River fishery, low popularity means low traffic in the area and reduced impacts as compared to scenarios B and D on riverbanks, private property, etc. And as in scenario A, the Kenai River fishery could see a small reduction in boat traffic and associated impacts, and the guiding industry around the Susitna dip netting would also be unlikely to grow significantly if there aren't that many new people participating. So now we'll go to Scenario D in Section 3.4. This one is called High Popularity, High Demand, or the Susitna River Boom. In this scenario, the Susitna River dipnet fishery becomes popular, drawing larger numbers of fishermen every year. In turn, those fishermen desire and vocalize abundant harvest opportunities, such as those on the Kenai and Kasilof Rivers. As a group, they create effective political and social pressure to increase the number of salmon available to harvest in the Susitna River watershed. This is now the rationale for Scenario D, Section 3.4.1. And I'm going to read this to you in much more detail because I think this really explains in depth how these scenarios might unfold, because this is certainly the most contentious possible scenario. Much like the gradual popularization of the Kenai and Kasilof dipnet fisheries in the 2000s and 2010s, the Susitna personal use fishery may gain popularity over the next several decades. If this fishery follows trends from the Kenai Peninsula fisheries, then this popularity will lead to an increased demand, both political and social pressure from Alaska's population center, which is Anchorage in the Mat-Su Valley, and their representatives, which are politicians and advocacy groups. That demand will be to increase harvest opportunities and, potentially, prioritize personal use fisheries above other user groups such as the commercial fleets, particularly in years of low sockeye stock abundance. On the Kenai Peninsula, this allocation argument has been framed around personal use fisheries being an opportunity for Alaskans to fill their freezers, and it shows up constantly in Board of Fish proposals. Improved harvest opportunities to meet high demand in this scenario could be potentially achieved several ways. First and most simply, the Board of Fish could expand the number of days per week that fishing is allowed in the Susitna-Dipnet fishery, which is currently set at 2 days per week. However, this would increase pressure on the existing salmon stock and would likely be linked with calls for increased abundance of the stock itself. That increased fish abundance could theoretically be achieved by increasing the number of fish produced in the Susitna River drainage by improving existing spawning and rearing habitat. A number of initiatives to do this are actually already underway. Another alternative would be to enhance salmon stocks via a hatchery program. The Gulf of Alaska is already stocked with approximately 1.8 billion, give or take, hatchery-reared juvenile salmon from Alaska's Salmon Enhancement Program, and that's every year. While the great majority of these fish are pink or humpy salmon, hatchery programs for other Pacific salmon species also exist and are used to stock personal-use fisheries. Currently, the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association manages the Iklutna Salmon Hatchery, which is north of Anchorage on the Kinnick Arm, and has previously used that hatchery to stock salmon in and around the Matsu and Anchorage areas. The hatchery is currently inoperative due to significant damage caused by the November 30, 2018 Anchorage earthquake, and would require significant capital investment to make it operational. That aside, increased demand in the Matsu region and Susitna-Dipnet fishery for sockeye, coho, and existing pressure to improve Chinook returns to the Susitna River could mobilize interest in rebuilding a hatchery program focused on improving dipnetting and angling opportunities for Susitna River fishers. This increased interest from non-commercial fishing user groups could also increase the funding base for aquaculture associations and enhancement projects in the Cook Inlet region, which are currently primarily funded by a self-levied tax on the commercial fishing industry. However, whether this scenario would be ecologically feasible or would gain political traction in the current atmosphere of tension, skepticism, and research around Alaska's Salmon Enhancement Program remains unknown. If demands were successful in creating greater fish abundance in the Susitna drainage through whatever mechanism, all user groups would likely enjoy some degree of improved harvest opportunity. The second thing to consider here is that demand for abundance could be approached by increasing the existing, or potentially enhanced, number of fish that return to the Susitna drainage by limiting fisheries that intercept Susitna-bound stocks. This scenario would create notable positive and negative impacts on other Cook Inlet user groups. For example, demand to see a larger volume of fish enter the Susitna River could result in pressure to limit the fishing time and spatial range of the Upper Cook Inlet and Northern District commercial fishing fleets, thus allowing northern-bound fish to pass through the inlet with minimal intercept. While Cook Inlet Fisheries Management has already taken steps to minimize significant intercept of Susitna drainage-bound salmon, such as the 2011 establishment of the colloquially known Conservation Corridor, the 2019-2020 cycle of the Board of Fish proposals and print media demonstrate a continued appetite for a larger allocation of salmon to northern Cook Inlet. So now Section 3.4.2, Impact on User Groups and the Environment. Importantly, a reduction in commercial catch could have secondary impacts on Cook Inlet fisheries user groups, as well as surrounding communities. For example, in order to reduce commercial catch, particularly of Chinook salmon in Upper Cook Inlet, a buyback program for Upper Cook Inlet set net permit holders was proposed to the Alaska State Legislature, with both advocates and opponents in the fishing community at large. Under this scenario, existing interest in a buyout program could accelerate with additional public pressure from increased use and interest in Matsu fisheries. There's a strong public perception and some empirical evidence that setnet gear has an outsized negative impact on king salmon runs, and as king salmon are a desired sport fish both on the Kenai Peninsula and in the Matsu watershed, where king numbers have seen serious decline, this line of reasoning could create additional pressure to enact a UCI setnet buyback. If a buyback takes place, however, the resulting reduced supply of Upper Cook Inlet commercial fishing permits could drive up permit prices and make it financially difficult for young and new fishermen to enter the fishery. This difficulty has been documented in other fisheries as one of the contributors toward Alaska's grain of the fleet phenomenon. From an in-river fisheries perspective, including both recreational and indigenous fisheries, the impacts of this scenario could be mixed. If greater fish abundance in the Susitna River was pursued by limiting Upper Cook Inlet commercial fish harvest, in-river fishermen in both Kenai Peninsula and Susitna River watersheds would likely see an increase of harvestable salmon abundance. However, this increase in abundance could be a double-edged sword for Susitna drainage sport fishermen, as this increase could intensify the popularity of the personal use fishery, thus limiting the overall increase in upstream salmon abundance. The Susitna River fishery and surrounding environment would also likely see significant change. As has happened with the Kenai River dipnet fishery in particular, an increase in popularity would drive demand for adequate facilities to accommodate the growing number of fishery users, including but not limited to additional boat launch space, toilet and sanitation facilities, fish waste disposal, regulatory enforcement officers, and other amenities. An increase in dip netting traffic, particularly prior to the development of public facilities, may also create erosion and trespassing and privacy issues for landowners who hold property bordering the fishery, a potential source of stakeholder conflict. From a different point of view, the demand for this infrastructure and access to the fishery could create economic opportunity for river guides and other local businesses in the Matsu area. Meanwhile, increasing popularity in the Susitna River fishery could result in positive changes for the Kenai and Kasilof River environments, such as decreased crowding on the beaches and boat traffic in the rivers, and associated reductions in erosion, pollution, etc. Kenai Peninsula dipnet guides would likely not see significant change unless the guiding industry on the Susitna River became substantial. Conversely, this reduction in crowds could also have negative economic consequences for the city of Kenai and other government entities who have made substantial capital investments into new roads, parking lots, waste management, and other infrastructure improvements to accommodate the current popularity of those Kenai Peninsula dipnet fisheries. In terms of Kenai River and Kasilof River salmon runs, research on whether large volumes of salmon returning to the Kenai that surpass optimum sustained yield or maximum sustained yield limits, such as could arise if commercial fleets were suddenly out of the way, would have lasting negative impacts on future salmon size or recruitment is mixed. That said, Cook Inlet rivers are currently managed using escapement goals around optimum sustained yield for the purpose of avoiding negative ecological outcomes for salmon stocks and to maximize the harvest benefits for all users by achieving maximum sustained yield as required for Cook Inlet salmon stocks, whose management falls under the Magnuson-Stevens Act. A scenario where commercial catch is curtailed or lessened due to a smaller fleet could result in overescapement and a decrease in spawning efficiency. Now we'll move on to section 4, which is the discussion. The scenarios developed and laid out in this paper, while surely not all-encompassing of every possible future variable, lay out multiple visions of the future. So as to help fisheries managers, Alaska Board of Fisheries members, and fishermen understand the landscape around the expansion of personal use fisheries in Cook Inlet. By offering this information and anticipated changes to the Cook Inlet fisheries atmosphere, already a deeply complex and contested socio-political arena, it is the author's hope that productive discussions focused on ecological sustainability and social equity can be had prior to further significant political, ecological, economic, or social changes within these fisheries. Time for this process is likely short, as early indicators of demand of an increased fish return on the Susitna River drainage is already visible, and concern about the growing personal use sector and impacts it may have on the already contentious allocation wars in Cook Inlet fisheries and salmon stocks are present in commercial, personal use, and environmental NGO sectors. Social ecological coexistence theory principles build upon coexistence theory, a fundamental feature of which is that of limited similarity. Phil Loring explores this concept in the context of Cook Inlet fisheries in his 2016 paper, finding that spatial differentiation of existing fisheries have, by and large, created sufficient limitations to similarity between user groups in this region. Loring also notes, however, that the abundance of sockeye salmon in Cook Inlet has likely been an important stabilizing mechanism, a finding supported by the increased tensions and conflicts that appear in years of low abundance, particularly in the for high-value species such as king salmon. Building upon those ideas, social ecological coexistence theory offers an additional set of helpful concepts, adaptation, pluralism, and equity, that we can use to examine the outcomes of the scenarios identified in the study as they relate to improving or detracting from the already contentious coexistence of Cook Inlet fisheries. In particular, I draw from this theoretical framework to evaluate how the introduction of the Susitna River personal use fishery and the different scenarios that may result because of it impact equity between existing user groups within Cook Inlet fisheries, and I look at what equalizing mechanisms exist or could be introduced. So now section 4.1, equity under different scenarios. First, Alaskans in the Cook Inlet region have diverse opportunities to harvest and consume locally caught Alaskan salmon, though these different fishing niches do not always coexist harmoniously due to lack of pluralistic values. As most groups act to reduce loss, whether that loss is perceived or otherwise, or to limit access or opportunity to harvest for other user groups, While the opening of the Susitna River personal use fishery aims to further diversify opportunities to fish, this study demonstrates that only the low-demand scenarios, which were status quo and fishing for fun, increase fishing opportunity without producing different winners and losers in terms of access to fish and time to harvest, and potentially shifts in political power, all of which would likely intensify conflict and reduce equity across the fisheries. Looking toward issues of equity, we should consider both social and ecological outcomes resulting from the new personal use fishery. From a social standpoint, in scenarios with low demand, the new Susitna River personal use fishery may reduce, or perhaps redistribute, dip netting pressure on the salmon resource, crowding, and in-river boat traffic conflicts, particularly between commercial and personal use watercraft, as they happen to take place on the Kenai and Kasilof rivers. That would thereby improve overall safety, well-being, and equity for the resource and all involved user groups. Conversely, high popularity scenarios may decrease equity for user groups upstream of the new personal use fishery, who will find themselves now competing for an overall comparatively low abundance resource. This may be of particular concern to lodge owners and others who have made significant investments into attracting anglers to fish their tributary of the Susitna River. High-demand scenarios, meanwhile, are more likely to negatively impact downstream users, particularly the Upper Cook Inlet commercial salmon fleets, who could see reduced access and opportunity to fish, and positively impact upstream users, and potentially Northern District commercial fishermen and indigenous fisheries. Conversely, limiting Central Cook Inlet commercial harvests could potentially allow larger runs of fish to be intercepted by Northern District commercial fishermen, of whom there are far fewer than in other commercial districts, and be available in the in-river fisheries for personal use and eventually recreational and indigenous fishermen. Alternatively, commercial fishing restrictions may be inclusive of Northern District commercial fishermen as well. Deciding factors would likely include complex political and ecological factors such as run strength and king salmon returns. All of these outcomes are due, in part, to the serial nature of Cook Inlet fisheries, where some user groups inevitably have access to migrating fish before others, and it highlights the crucial aspect of where power and influence lie along the serial line of fisheries access. In other words, shifts in power away from marine user groups, who are typically first in line for fish in the system, to in-river users or toward in-river users, including shifts in high-level authorities such as the Board of Fish, could have significant consequences on access and fishing time for marine users, and vice versa. From an ecological perspective, increased utilization of the Susitna River's fish resources due to high popularity may result in increased interest in the health of the Susitna River watershed and buoy public opinion of conservation efforts that are already well underway. Simultaneously, high popularity scenarios may increase environmental pressure due to increased boat traffic, waste management challenges, accessibility challenges, and the eventual demand for establishing infrastructure at or around the fishing area. Also noteworthy is the removal of the stock of concern status at the same time the Susitna personal use fishery was established. The new fishing user group and the potential pressure that they may put on this tenuous stock raises questions as to whether this fishery decreases environmental equity or the opportunity, or perhaps even right, of the fishery to continue its recovery without additional fishing pressure. Importantly, such shifts in power balance and fisheries access can cause system-wide ripple effects, raising questions of social equity beyond the fisheries themselves. As previous research has found, personal use fisheries are good opportunities for recreation and household-scale harvest of salmon, thereby improving food security outcomes. However, commercial fisheries also provide an important economic engine to the Kenai Peninsula and South Central Alaska more broadly, and also contribute to the availability of seafood in local food systems. Importantly, participation in commercial fisheries also requires substantial investment on the part of the fishermen, and consistent, predictable regulatory conditions are important to planning the many logistical challenges of fishing every season. Yet, personal use fishers and fisheries are viewed by users as an important opportunity to harvest fish and recreate, and are enjoyed by a substantial number of households each year. With these issues in the balance, it is a significant managerial challenge as to how to balance, or more precariously, try and prioritize, the needs of these various user groups. Section 4.2, Equalizing Mechanisms. Equalizing mechanisms, in short, ensure that a species, or in this case, user groups in a fishery, are not displaced and can remain resilient to change. In this analysis, existing equity within Cook Inlet fisheries is best maintained under the, quote, status quo scenario, where the new personal use fishery is used by those whose primary enjoyment is derived from the experience of fishing, and overwhelming popularity and demand for increased fishery abundance do not materialize. However, as the other three scenarios may also come to pass, it is worthwhile to consider what equalizing measures exist within Cook Inlet fisheries, whether they will be effective under scenarios of increasing popularity and demand, and what additional measures might be considered. Since its inception in the mid-1990s, the personal use fishery in Alaska has seen significant growth, while other user group participation in Upper Cook Inlet has generally remained stable due to mechanisms such as limited entry for commercial fisheries and competitive limitations for in-river users, such as available fishing space in competition within the guiding industry. Loring points out that the two-tiered system of the Board of Fish and Alaska Department of Fish and Game to allocate and manage, respectively, Upper Cook Inlet fisheries fish stocks for, quote, the maximum benefit of the people, end quote, theoretically acts as an equalizing mechanism. Indeed, equalizing mechanisms are also built into the Alaska Constitution by allowing the state of Alaska to, quote, limit entry into any fishery for purposes of resource conservation, to prevent economic distress amongst fishermen and those dependent upon them for livelihoods, etc., end quote. And that's from the Alaska Constitution, Article 8, Section 15. However, these mechanisms are only effective in maintaining the coexistence of Cook Inlet fishery user groups if no one group is able to exert a competitive advantage over another. Particularly under scenarios of high popularity and demand, there is the possibility of personal use fishermen, who significantly outnumber other user groups in terms of number of actual participating Alaskan residents, that they may be able to collectively wield significant political power through their elected officials. This power could disrupt, even incrementally, current equalizing mechanisms such as the Board of Fish composition, and by extension, allocative distribution of fishing access and time for both upstream and downstream users. Currently, there is no limit to how many people may participate on any one day or in any one season in personal use fisheries beyond the requirement for Alaskan residency. And so participation and, under some scenarios, demand for salmon abundance could continue to grow significantly. Such an outcome would result in a decrease in equity for other groups who, among other reasons, have made significant social, cultural, and economic investments in their established fishing activities. What equalizing measures could be put in place to allow for the most equitable scenarios to unfold? Equalizing mechanisms could work in two and possibly more ways. First, mechanisms could be designed to address the issue of popularity, something that has already been discussed in Alaskan public media, as a way to control crowding on the popular Kenai Peninsula personal use fisheries. From a management perspective, in-season reporting of personal use takes could also help managers more accurately determine the overall harvest, and such measures could improve feelings of equity in other fleets where regular in-season reporting is required. From the demand side, equalizing mechanisms could potentially be effective by helping the personal use user groups set realistic expectations for their fishing and harvesting experiences. For example, by educating users about the migrating patterns of salmon through Cook Inlet and the potential for a mismatch between the timing of a fishing trip and the run abundance on any given day. Another mechanism might be setting ratios around how much of a run each fleet may harvest. Though this would almost certainly be a politically contentious set of measures to institute, it would limit the overall take of all user groups and help maintain equity as user group sizes change over time. One add-on benefit to such a measure would be an increase to the overall predictability of Cook Inlet fisheries management, as user groups would reasonably predict the limits to which their group could harvest based on overall run size. Important to these two possible equalizing mechanisms is the inherently political nature of the Alaska Board of Fisheries. Unto itself, the board could be considered an equalizing mechanism in that its composition reflects the priorities of whatever gubernatorial administration and legislature is in power. However, Board of Fish comments from Section 1.1.2 of this paper reflect this body's tendency to act progressively toward their own perceptions of user equity based on politicized issues of resident versus non-resident harvest and percent of harvest taken by particular user groups and influence from organizations involved in long-standing disputes within the contentious Cook Inlet fisheries atmosphere. Thus, instead of an equalizing mechanism, the Board of Fish may instead sometimes act as an accelerant to political momentum around allocation struggles between Cook Inlet user groups. In other words, without detailed consideration of how policy changes may play out, across the complex network of Cook Inlet Fisheries, Board of Fish efforts to pursue equity may actually contribute to further destabilizing regional coexistence if they do not account for and prioritize social ecological pluralism. To maximize equity amongst all Cook Inlet user groups, including local communities and the environment in which these fisheries take place, equalizing mechanisms around the expansion of personal use fisheries will be important to assess and implement. Without such steps, the scenarios developed here in this manuscript that lead to decreased equity for some user groups, particularly scenarios with high popularity and high demand, are likely to be realized. That said, I do acknowledge as the author that the politically contentious challenge of the imposition of such limits from any managerial body would be huge. Thus, seeking ideas for such limits and building consensus around their instatement within Cook Inlet fishery user groups, particularly amongst personal use fishermen, will be critical to their success. And I just want to emphasize that point, that we've seen over and over again, including at the time of this recording, a recent decision to close portions of Cook Inlet to drift fishing. It is so critical to listen to stakeholders and to include them in decision-making, particularly around proposing alternatives or amendments or proposals, whatever the case may be, to change something about these fisheries. The fishermen must be included. And that is just not something that's really happened in much of Cook Inlet decision-making, unfortunately. So I appreciate that as I do offer these suggestions in this paper, that requirement to include fishermen in that decision-making is just absolutely vital. Section 5, the conclusion. I'll summarize here by saying that by drawing on from important concepts in social ecological coexistence theory, scenario development on the expansion of personal use fisheries in Cook Inlet shows us there's several possible versions of the future. And my hope is that by laying these out, it gives opportunity for managers and other invested groups to think critically about equity and about what equalizing mechanisms might be instituted to promote equity between user groups in the future. This case demonstrates that the phenomenon of improving pluralism in fisheries without consideration of how growth of one group affects others is a very serious issue. By considering these future scenarios, institutions like the Board of Fisheries and other allocative bodies might be able to better consider the impacts of otherwise well-intended allocation decisions and hopefully avoid intensifying the conflict in this already conflict-ridden system. Now, practically, of course, this is much easier said than done, or more easily recommended than done in the case of this paper. The Board of Fish, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and other decision-making bodies in Alaskan fisheries management already have many demands on their resources, and decision-making criteria for these bodies do not explicitly include equity, pluralism, or equalizing measures. That said, one solution might be to actually do more of what this paper does. It may be to delay the implementation of proposals that are adopted by the Board of Fish by, say, up to 1 year, and allow for a scenario development type study or analysis to be done on each proposal that's chosen. Alternatively, the Board of Fish could outsource that process to the people who write proposals. And to be fair, they already do this a little bit by asking how will any given proposal affect Cook Inlet fisheries, but they could require proposal writers to consider more explicit questions around potential impacts of their proposals, such as how it would impact every user group in the area and what could be done to minimize conflicts between user groups. This is certainly more pertinent to Cook Inlet specifically than it is to other places, but I do think that line of thinking is really valuable when we have an open public process that allows anyone to submit proposals for change. Whether these or any of the other solutions I've proposed here are adopted, the creation of new fisheries or expansion of certain user group opportunities for harvest will certainly continue to be contentious as long as Cook Inlet social ecological systems are treated as a zero-sum game. Thanks for listening to this episode of PubCasts. Today's episode was a reading of Managing Many Nets, Possible Scenarios and Impacts for the Expansion of Cook Inlet Personal Use Fisheries by me, Hannah L. Harrison, published in the journal Fisheries Research. To hear more PubCasts, visit the Coastal Roots Project website at www.coastalroots.org. That's www.coastalroots.org. To read this paper and other papers that I've published on this same area, please visit ResearchGate and search for Hannah L. Harrison. Thanks for listening.